Welcome to Reconciled Church Miami, Pastor Aldo Leon.
Here we are in chapter 4, and what's important about chapter 4 is there's been something in this book that is about, what is Judges about? Judges is about a time, this book is written, Ruth has been in the time of Judges, where everybody does whatever they want. And they do whatever they want in the time of the Mosaic Law. When Israel was under the law, basically everybody did what they feel like. So this book is God's story answer to how we deal with our lawlessness in light of the fact that law can do nothing for us in our sinfulness. So chapter 2, we talked about family, brotherly affection is God's answer. All in chapter 2, we have this love and grace that God gives us through our greater Boaz showed in the lesser Boaz. And in chapter 3, we had this other description that what we need in our lawlessness is a husband who loves us gracefully outside of anything in us. But there's a problem that we have not dealt with yet. There's an elephant in the room of Ruth. And that is the law of God. You can't, see, the thing is, you realize that everybody here is bound to the law. You must, as a human being, you know this. You have a conscience that tells you this from beginning, that you must obey God perfectly, and there is punishment that should happen to you for disobedience. So, what is Ruth's answer to that issue? Because, yes, we talked about the grace of God coming in a family. Yes, we talked about the grace of God coming in a husband. But what about the law? You think you can just, God just forgive you and just say, forget about the law? Kind of like how people say today, you know, hey, God just kind of just says, hey, I love you, it's okay, you're in my family. Don't worry about the law of God, which demands perfection from you. So, what this chapter shows us is what God does with the elephant in the room. What does God do with the law? The things that we should and must do to obey and honor God's glory, what does God do with that? And it's very interesting because in chapter 3, remember, Boaz is like, look, I want you, Ruth, but there's this guy further, closer along the line to redeem you who has the right of redemption. So Boaz is like, look, I want you, but there's someone closer in the line that has a right to you that I got to deal with. So the law demands that the person who was the closest relative to be the one who would take the, you know, the widow and the homeless person. Boaz says, I got to take care of that. And so this individual, this guy who's the closest relative to Ruth and Naomi's family, he represents the law of God. So it's almost like, you know, like in the, you kind of take ideas and concepts and you give them a character, you personify them. This guy, this closest relative, really represents the law of God and the laws of God, ability to save us. And Boaz represents the grace redeemer outside of the law. Y'all following me? This character in chapter 4, who is closest to Ruth, represents the law of God. So our story now brings out this guy. He brings out the law of God. He brings out the standard and shows once and for all what is to be done with standards in the church. And so there's going to be like 4 just general ideas that I'm going to bring out to help you see what do we do with the law of God in our lives as we seek to be saved by grace. And the first thing we see in this chapter is that Christ, first of all, he punishes our confidence in law keeping. He just squashes it by showing how this guy really operates. Second thing he does is he promotes our confidence in his law keeping. The third thing he does is that he shows how Christ's law keeping for us is promoted in the church community. And the last thing, he just gives this really sweeping, big conclusion about law in the church. So, all right, there's an elephant in the room. It's the law of God. It pricks your conscience. You know you're not right. You know you must obey. You know something must be done. Here we go. Point number 1. Christ punishes our confidence in law keeping. Look what it says in verse 1. Boaz went to the gate of the town and sat down. Now, I have to explain a lot so you understand. The gate of the town is almost like the courtroom, the court system in our day. So in our day, they didn't have like an official court system. They had the town gate. So this represents the highest court, the highest place where things are settled. So obviously, Boaz in his city, he has, you know, the courtroom of the city, the gates. But we know that our greater Boaz, Christ, has the courtrooms of heaven. So this is the courtroom of Boaz in the town, but we're looking to the greater courtroom of heaven. So Boaz, he comes and he sits in the gate and he sits down. And soon the family redeemer that Boaz had spoken by came by. Boaz called him by name and said, come over here and sit down. So he went over there and sat down. So this is the first thing Christ does to show us what do we do with the law. He first shows us that law keeping is his priority, not our priority. Boaz calls this meeting. He sits down. He basically is the one who is making this his issue to solve. No one else in this town. Ruth is not even there. She's somewhere else. Boaz says, look, your law issue is something that is my responsibility to deal with, not yours. You know, it's almost like you get hired by a boss to, you know, push papers and answer phones, and then you walk into the meeting where the boss is deciding, you know, the future of the company, and you tell him, hey, this is what I want to do, and he's like, yo, I didn't hire you for that. It's my job to deal with where the company's going. And so Boaz shows us here is that, guys, listen to me. Your law issue that you struggle with in your conscience is not your problem to deal with. Boaz calls a meeting. It's Boaz's job to deal with your law issue. Ruth is not even in this picture. This is Boaz's problem to deal with. That's the first thing we see. The second thing that we see is that Boaz shows us his authority and power over the law that he has alone in verses 1 and 2. Look, Boaz sits down, he calls a meeting, he looks at the relative who represents the law and says, you sit down over here, you listen to me what I tell you. Then the other witnesses come and he says, you guys sit down. Boaz is showing us that he has authority over the law and in a way no one else does. You know, a lot of times we try to act like we have authority over the law, right? This is what you do. This is what I do. We say, I will not be angry. I will love God more. I will love difficult people. I will stop being critical. I will stop failing people. I will kind of bend the law. And what happens? The law just kicks your butt. You get in the ring with the law, and you're like, all right, I see all the standards. I will. And it just knocks you down. But guess what? When Boaz gets in the ring of the law, he commands authoritatively, powerfully, the law to do what he wants. He obeys perfectly. He submits perfectly under it. God, Jesus says to the wind, stop, and it stops. He says to the water, let me walk on it, and he walks on it. He says to dead people, rise, and they rise. And he looks at the law of God, all its standards, and Boaz authoritatively manhandles it by himself. It's his job. It's his authoritative place to handle your law issue, not yours. So that's the second thing we see about how Christ really just dissolves this kind of confidence we have. And us being okay to the law is doing that. He also shows us its true place in our lives. He shows the law's true place in our lives. And in the Holman, it says he called the Redeemer by name. But if you look at other translations, they just say, he just said to the friend. But if you read it in the Hebrew, you know what it says about this guy? It says so-and-so. So this guy, the kinsman redeemer, the closest relative, Boaz just says, there's so-and-so. He don't even call him by name. And let me tell you where I'm going with that. You guys know, like, when you don't focus on someone's name, typically it's because they're not going to be in the picture for a significant period of time, right? You're like, you know, it's not really important to know that person's name because they're just kind of coming in and they're going to be out really soon. You know, just don't worry about that. So here comes the guy who represents the law of God, and he says, yo, there's so-and-so. Don't worry about that. He's just going to be here for a time, and then he's going to kind of take his place later. So there's a passage that I really like that we actually went through. It's in Galatians 3. Galatians 3, 23. Listen to this. Listen, this is kind of like the same idea that we get. And Boaz looking at the law and saying, yo, there's so-and-so. Don't even worry about who he is, what his name is, because I'm about to put him out of the picture. Galatians 3, 23, Paul says this. Before this faith came, we were confined under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith was revealed. Then the law was our guardian until Christ, so that we could be justified by faith. But since that faith has come, we're no longer under a guardian. So basically, in this story, law dude comes down, the law comes down, so-and-so's there, he's about to be out of the picture. Basically, Jesus says, he's not that significant, I'm more significant, don't worry about that. His only place is to show you that I have the primary place in your life, not the law. Y'all follow me or all this stuff confusing you? It's like, I'm not even going to tell you if it was. So think about this. Take every standard in your life, okay? All those standards in your life, think about it. All the standards in your life that you think if you can keep them and you can accomplish them that you will feel ultimately good about yourself, all of them. And you know what you should do? You should cross them out and say, that's so-and-so. And in the name of, after you cross so-and-so out, you put Jesus Christ and him crucified. Every standard in your life that you think is going to somehow move you and control you and define you, you say, you know what? That's so-and-so, Jesus and him crucified takes the place. Because the law, brother and sister, has one purpose. The law has one purpose, to come in and make way to show you that Jesus is your righteousness. That's the law's purpose. He's so-and-so. He's just coming in, he's going out. So that's what Jesus does. He shows us the law's true place by talking to him this way. He also shows us its inability in the highest realm. Yo, Boaz says, look, we're going to bring the guy who represents the law, we're going to bring him into the highest court. So he's like, all right, in front of everybody in the highest court, can you save that woman? Go ahead. And you're going to see, basically, dude's like, nah, I can't. So Boaz says, look, the law may serve purposes in lesser jurisdictions, but when you bring it to the highest one of heaven, guess what? Can't do nothing. It's kind of like Monopoly money. Y'all play Monopoly anymore? You know, Monopoly, you can use your Monopoly money to play the game. But when it comes to real estate and buying stuff, it don't work. So the law has a place. We need laws. I get it. We have laws for, you know, the home. And we have laws for government. And we have laws for security. But in the courtroom of heaven, that Monopoly money got no currency at all. There's no currency of law in heaven that when you bring the law and the do-gooding that you can do or accomplish, when you bring it to the highest courtroom, guess what? Get that Monopoly money out of here. It don't count up here. The only currency that counts in heaven is blood money. Blood money. The blood of Jesus Christ is the only currency that's valid in the highest courtroom. Get your Monopoly money, law keeping out of here. Don't work up there. He shows us in the highest realm, in the courtroom of heaven, it does nothing. He shows us something else. He shows us all that can do is hypothetical, not actual. All the law can do is hypothetical, not actual. Look at it says in verse 4 and 6. This is Boaz talking to the guy who represents the law, the closest relative. I should inform you. Buy it back in those seated here in the presence of the elders and my people. If you would not want to redeem it, do so. But if you don't want to redeem it, tell me so I will know because there isn't anyone other than you to redeem it, and I'm next after you. This is what the law guy says. I want to redeem it. Yeah, I want the property. I want the place for God's people to be. Then Boaz says, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you will also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of the deceased man, to perpetuate the man's name on his property. Then the redeemer replies, I can't redeem it. You see that? You know, so the law of God, right? It's perfect standards. They basically say that if you obey perfectly, heart, mind, soul, and strength, you can have a place with God. You know? And so we say, you know, we have these Christian kind of slogans. We should surrender to God perfectly, and we should love Him with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and we should give our all for God, and we should always, you know, kind of say no to sin, and we should never be racist, and we should never be selfish. Sounds great. But when the law calls your number, no one does that perfectly. It's all hypothetical. The law says, all right, I'll buy someone back. And then Boaz says, okay, there's a sinner. He's like, nah, I can't do that. It's all hypothetical, you know? You can talk day and night about how people should be this way and they must be this way. But when the law calls your number, there are no candidates to be redeemed by doing the law. Nobody. It's all hypothetical. It's kind of like, remember when the people try to throw the woman who committed adultery before Jesus, and they say, kill her with stones. Jesus is like, all right, law, right? Who is sinless? Why don't you beat her down? The law calls a number, and there's no candidates that can actually respond to its call. So, guys, we could talk day and night about how we should be this way and how we should be that way, but nobody obeys the law of God perfectly. It cannot redeem absolutely anybody. Never. Never. There has never been a person who could look at the law of God and actually say, yes, I think I can make it. No, it never happens. So something else we see, the law shows us that we're a baggage it cannot carry. You know, like he's like, man, if I take that woman, it's going to ruin my inheritance. So basically, like, if I bring her in, it just jacks me all up. Perfect standards looks at an imperfect person and says, if I attach myself to that imperfect person, it just messes me all up. You know, it's kind of like one little drop of poison in a clean glass of water is enough to just poison all the water. That's all it is. You know, and it's kind of like, we're not just one drop of imperfection. We're like kind of buckets and buckets and buckets of it. But the law looks at our baggage. The law looks at you and says, I want nothing to do with you. You, if I attach myself to you, then we can't have anything together because you're corrupt and I'm perfect. Think about that, guys. So much conversation in the church is all about all these kind of systems of law and perfection and improve yourself. And the law says, yo, I don't want nothing to do with you. When all the standards attach themselves to an imperfect person, they say, yo, you messed me up. You messed me up. I can't attach myself to you. And notice what Boaz also says. He says, look, not only do you have to attach yourself to this imperfect person, law, but you also have to produce children. So basically, Boaz is saying, hey, law, standard, why don't you produce life from death? It's almost like you thinking this way. You go to a cemetery, and you go up to a dead person, and you tell the dead person this, love God and love your neighbor. What does it matter if you tell a dead person to love God and love neighbor? They're dead. Law can't do nothing for dead people. So Boaz says, all right, law, you want to redeem? All right, why don't you produce life where there's death? And law says, I can't do that. Of course not. The law cannot redeem a dead person, and that's what we are. We're not just imperfect people who make mistakes. We are dead people in need of resurrection. Law can't do jack for your death issue. You have a question about that? Go to a cemetery and start commanding law to dead people and see how responsive they are. We are baggage that it can do nothing to deal with that baggage. This is the last way. This is the last way that Boaz punishes our confidence in law. He memorializes its inability to do anything to save us. Memorializes its inability to do anything to save us. Look what it says in verse 7 and 8. At the earlier period, so when Boaz says, hey, can you get her? Law's like, nah, I can't. This is what Boaz does. An earlier period in Israel, a man removed his sandal, took his shoe off, and gave it to the other party in order to make any matter legally binding concerning the right of redemption of the exchange of property. This was a method of legally binding a transaction in Israel. So the redeemer removed his sandal and said to Boaz, buy back the property yourself. So basically, if you can't buy back the sinner in their issue, take your shoe off and give it to the person who can. That's the ceremony. So every time you see that guy who cannot purchase the sinner, you say, dude got no shoes, he can't walk, he can't stand, he could do nothing for that person. You know, Boaz says we need to memorialize, take the shoe off the law in the church, so every time we look at a perfect standards, say, got no shoes. You know, make that thing, make the law look barefoot, it can't stand, it can't move, it can't do anything, and you know what? Always have him barefoot. Doesn't exchange the shoe for a period of time, you know? So you guys have a lot of things that you think can save you. Men, you think that your position and your skills and your strength can somehow make you right. But Boaz says, yo, that thing got no shoes on it. And you know who's wearing that shoe? Christ is wearing that shoe. Christ is wearing that shoe. Or, you know, some of you, you know, you think that fixing your marriage and fixing your rebellious kids is somehow going to give you a place to stand on. Boaz is saying, yo, you fixing your marriage and you fixing your kids got no shoes. Christ is wearing that shoe. Christ is wearing that shoe to move you, justify you, and save you. You fixing that is not going to do anything. Got no shoes. Got no shoes. Looks strange. Or some of you think that, you know, fixing the world and doing justice and serving the poor and, you know, all these other things, that maybe if I can kind of fix the world and fix society and do this, and no shoes. No shoes to make you right before God. Or some of you ladies may think, man, if my husband were to treat me a certain way and love me a certain way, then maybe before God I can have confidence. That's got no shoes either. You know who's wearing that shoe? Boaz is wearing that shoe. Boaz got that shoe on. That got no shoes either, you know. Or some of you may think, man, you know, like, if I could just kind of fix this and improve this and perform here, if I could just kind of, you know, if I could just commit to Christ a little bit harder, then maybe I will have something to stand on. And Boaz says, yo, in the church, that always has no shoes. Boaz is wearing that shoe. Always. And it's ironic to me, guys, because in the church, we're always promoting barefoot, can't move, can't stand Christianity. As opposed to saying, you know what we got in the church? Every standard that we try to define ourselves by is barefoot, and Christ wears the shoe for that. He says, you remember that, you memorialize that, you take that into account with how you view the law. It's barefoot, and Christ wears the shoe. So after Christ kind of squashes our confidence in the law, he then promotes himself. And he does this firstly, I'll just say, Christ promotes our confidence in his law-keeping, not ours. So look what he does in verse 9. He publicly promotes his ownership of us outside of the law. Christ publicly promotes how he owns you outside of anything you do. You say, why do you say that? Look, after the law comes into the picture, Ruth, law, can y'all make something work? No, you can't. Boaz says this. Boaz said to the elders of all the people, you are witnesses today that I am buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech, Chilion, Mahlon. I will also acquire Ruth the Moabitess. So Boaz is like, look, I'm calling an assembly. I'm making a conference. I'm making this big religious announcement. And you know what it is? Is that though these people can do nothing under the law to redeem themselves, I buy them outside of anything they do. That's the church's public announcement. That's Boaz's heavenly public announcement. You know, it's like a lot of times we think like this. Okay, grace is this little announcement that we announce to people. Okay? Grace. And then we publicly declare, hey, you must be this way, do this, accomplish this to be right. But Boaz says, no, you know what the announcement is in heaven? You know what Christ is declaring to his community, sinner? That though you could have absolutely nothing, never to do anything to help you at all, Christ says, I own them because of that, in spite of them, always. That's the announcement of heaven. Not the announcement of heaven is like, let's see how they do. Let's put them on probation for a, you know, do-over. Or, you know, second chances. No. The announcement of heaven, as you see this woman, she can't do nothing to save herself. The law can't help her. I own her outside of anything she does. That's what Christ promotes in heaven. So I wonder if this is what Christ is promoting in heaven. Man, I got lost in my paperwork. This is not good. Okay, I'm found in my paperwork. Good grief, dude. This has never happened to me before. So look, let me try to get to where I was. Guys, if Boaz's public announcement, if his emphatic declaration is basically that he owns sinners outside of anything they do, what's the public announcement in your house? If I were to go in your house, what would be the declaration in your house? Man, I am publicly declaring to everyone in this house that Boaz in heaven says, yo, I own you guys outside of anything you do. Or is the public announcement in your house the opposite? So Boaz, he promotes our confidence in his law keeping by saying, yo, I publicly promote the fact that I own you outside of anything you do. And look what else he does. He also publicly owns all our lawless baggage. He publicly owns all our lawless baggage. Listen to me again. He publicly owns all our lawless baggage. Verse 9. Look what it says. Boaz said to the elder of the people, you are witnesses today that I'm buying from Naomi everything that belonged to Elimelech. Remember Elimelech, the scandalous pagan sellout dude? Chilion and Mahlon, the other pagan sellout dudes. I will also require Ruth the Moabitess. He calls out her pagan background, Mahlon's widow, as my wife. So a lot of times, so Boaz says, you know what? I will declare and take credit for and own all of their lawlessness. A lot of times, this is how we think. We think like this. We all know we have sin issues. We know we're screwed up. But we try to kind of just add some like good baggage, happy baggage, religious baggage to make us feel better. So like a lot of us men, we struggle in the house and we're, you know, our families are a mess. And you know what we do? We try to be a beast in the job and be a beast in entertainment and be a beast in all these things to make ourselves feel better. So let me get some better baggage over there, you know. Or some of us, we have guilt and shame from our past. And you know what we do? We go in the church and we try to acquire some like kind of religious church baggage to make us feel better. That's how we fix it. You know, or some of us, we just look at ourselves deep down and we really know that we're just not who we should be. And we just try to be the best mom we could be to make ourselves feel better. But that's not what Boaz does. Boaz basically says, you see all the baggage attached to Ruth, all the sin, all the death, all the scandal, I own it. It's mine. It's all mine. The whole cargo full of sin and death and garbage and filth, Boaz says, I own it, I declare it, it's mine to be responsible for. As opposed to trying to like balance the scales. You know, so whatever it is, Boaz, you know, adultery, I own it. Abortion, I own it. Thieving, lying, hypocrisy, ruined relationships, destruction, homosexuality. I take all the baggage of my people and I say, charge it to my account. He said, take all of it. All that, all the death, all the scandal, all the just ridiculous things attached to them. Just credit that to my account. I will bury it in my blood and death. Guys, the church oftentimes think like, oh, Jesus, I'm a Christian now. Could you now make me have like good baggage and do good things to feel better about my baggage? That's how we act. We're running around trying to get all this religious, moral baggage to feel better about ourselves. Rather than saying, you know who Jesus is? He's someone in heaven who owns all your reckless, disgusting, and filthy baggage. And he says, I eradicated it. I buried it in the cross, in my death, and burial, and resurrection. That's who Boaz is in heaven. So much for, hey, man, let me kind of like tilt the scales. Boaz says, you see all that drama, all that mess? Charge it to my accounts. Rather than try to give them something to balance themselves, to make themselves feel better. So, moving on, you know, he also shows us, he promotes his law keeping by publicly and permanently giving us his reputation outside of law. He publicly and permanently gives us his reputation outside of law. Look what it says in verse 10. He says, I will also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, listen, to perpetuate the deceased man's name on his property so that his name will not disappear. You guys know biblically, name means your reputation, who you are. So Boaz not only owns all the lawless filth that's attached to Ruth, not only does he say, hey man, it's not about what you do. He says, I will restore your reputation because of my reputation. You know, you guys know a lot of times you have a reputation not because of anything you did, right? It's because your husband was this way, you have that reputation. Your kids were this way, you have that reputation. We understand that a lot of times we have a reputation attached to us not based upon what we do. It doesn't matter what you do because you're associated to that person. So that's what Boaz is doing here. He's basically saying that because my reputation is spotless, I will attach my reputation to these pagan, sellout, dying people and then bring those two worlds together. He brings those two worlds together. So he gives you his reputation outside of the law. The law says, hey, I can't save them. Boaz says, yeah, I can save them, and I will give them my reputation, even though they have no reputation. So I again ask, and in keeping with Father's Day, man, how are you trying to build your reputation around people? How much your wife respects you, how people treat you, how strong you are, how athletic you are, how smart you are. Or are you trying to say, you know what? I want to build my reputation by taking credit and ownership for the reputation of Jesus that he's accounted to me outside of anything that I do. Because that's what he does. He gives us his reputation. Or I would even ask you a question. How are you leading your wives, men? Are you trying to tell her, hey, let me tell you the good news. Let me treat you in light of the fact that though you have not done what you should do, your Boaz in heaven says, my perfect reputation is now yours. Do you treat her that way? Or do you treat her like the person who never meets up to the law standard? Because Boaz is in heaven promoting and giving us his reputation. So he promotes his law keeping outside of our law keeping. That's another way he does. But he also, thirdly, Christ is promoted among us in the church in his law keeping, not ours. So firstly, it was just how he promotes himself. And now thirdly, it's about how he promotes himself in the church. And the first way he does that is by making us spectators of the law, not performers of the law. By making us spectators of the law, not performers of the law. Look what it says in verse 11. So after Boaz's community sees what happens, the elders of the people at the gate say, we are witnesses. We are witnesses. And so I think a helpful picture of this is almost like the picture of, you know, like when your kids walk around just bragging about what they do all the time? That's the one picture. They're always saying, like, look at me, look at me, look at me. That's like one picture. I think that's the picture that we see the church as. How is Boaz, how is our greater Boaz exalted and made glorious in the church? It's through us being a bunch of kids who just say, look at me, look at me, look at me, watch me. But here's the other picture of the kid that I think is more helpful. The kid who's always saying, look at my dad, pay attention to my dad, watch my dad, check out my dad. That's the other picture. So one is always just promoting themselves, but the other one is just always pointing the figure at dad. And I think it's so helpful to us understand that, guys, if we are witnesses who basically attest to the fact that the law can't redeem us, but Christ redeemed us outside of law because of his law-keeping and sin-bearing, then the way Christ is promoted amongst us mostly is through us being announcers, heralds, proclaimers, declarers of his perfections, as opposed to thinking that Christ is primarily exalted amongst us by our pretended perfections. He says, you guys are witnesses. You know? You think about it. What is a church? I think a lot of times we think of the church primarily as being this institution of like do-gooders and kind of like human saviors, like these little Jesuses who just kind of like act like Jesus in the world. And I'm not saying we don't represent the character of Christ and we don't act like Christ, but what I'm saying is primarily and foundationally, first and foremost, we are witnesses that we could do absolutely nothing to save ourselves and that Boaz, Christ in heaven, has done absolutely everything. That's who we are. We are witnesses of that. That's the first thing. And that's so Christ says, look, the people of God say we are witnesses of all that just happened along with the law not being able to do and you, Boaz, stepping in and doing it. We see something else about the way Christ is promoted amongst us in his law keeping, not ours, is by him building a community from the lawless. By him building a community from the lawless. Look what it says in verse 11. Verse 11 says, the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah. So this woman gets saved in this kind of way, outside of the law, but because of Boaz. And the people in this room make the connection with Ruth all the way back to Rachel and Leah. And who are Rachel and Leah? Rachel and Leah are people in those kind of old narratives about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who were the women who brought forth basically the nation of Israel. So basically he's saying, look, you see these pagans who have no righteousness, cannot be saved by the law, and that are saved outside of anything they do because of Christ? That's what God's community will be built on. They point it back to these people who were the source of God's community. You know, it's almost like the difference between somebody, you know, a builder going into a place and seeing all these choice stones and saying, you know what, I can use that. That's a good piece of stone. I can use that. That's a good piece because I can do things on the basis of the quality of the pieces. Or the builder who says, you know what? I'm going to go to the garbage heap and I'm going to get all these jacked up, cracked, busted, fragile stones and then I'm going to make a building on the basis of those things. And so, guys, I think sometimes that's the way we see the church. We see the church almost as like God's in heaven kind of sweeping the world, seeing for people who have credentials to build a community of the church. Let me see human willpower. Who's willing? Let me see some little bit of obedience over here. Come on, like, let me look around and find some like ideal pieces to build a community of God. But we see here the very opposite. God is somebody, you know, God's more like, he's somebody who walks through a nuclear blast of ashes and death and just destruction. And out from that becomes this invincible, eternal community that is made entirely by the perfections and power of the builder and not the quality of the pieces in the building. That's a church. He says, may the people of God be built on pagans that have nothing but have a righteous Christ. May that be what the church is built on. The foundation is Christ. The glue that holds the stone together is gospel, and the framework is resurrection. So you know what? It don't matter how the pieces are. They can be as screwed up as they want because they're built on these strong things. So he builds a community from the lawless. Again, we're seeing really what the law is about as we see this unfold. So another thing I would say is that Christ also makes wonder from horror by love, not law. He makes wonder from horror by love, not law. Look at verse 12 and 13. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, border Judah, because the offspring the Lord will give you by this woman. Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and she was intimate with her. The Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Any of you guys know the story from Tamar and Judah? Any Bible nerds? Okay, let me tell you what happened with Tamar and Judah. Tamar is Judah's daughter-in-law. Okay, one of her sons was married to her. Dude died, and what happened was she couldn't get remarried, so she acts like a prostitute, okay? She acts like a prostitute, and Judah, because, you know, he was a womanizer, he goes into town, he sees a hot prostitute. He has sex with his daughter-in-law, and out comes life, which then results in the line that leads all the way to Jesus. The church community, Boaz's clan, they look at this and they say, may this situation, Ruth, which represents us, who's the church, may be like Tamar and Judah. Does that sound like a good situation to you? Hey, babies come out of prostitutes and pimps. But check this out. The reason for that story is that the most ugly situations and the most ugly people and the most disastrous, just lawless things are the things God uses still to bring beauty outside of anything in them. That's the whole point of that story. Out of pimps and prostitutes comes life. Why? Why? Because Jesus, our righteous Boaz, powerful and mighty, attaches himself to lawless and hopeless people who have nothing in them, and in doing that, life comes. Not giving lawless, disgusting people law, but he attaches them to himself, and beauty comes from attaching beauty to horror. That's the whole point of saying, you know what? This Ruth and Boaz thing goes back to this Tamar and Judah thing. You know, and I mean, a really practical way for me to illustrate this is, guys, I a lot of times found a lot of different ways to try to save myself as an unbeliever through law. You know, first I tried psychiatry and psychology. My parents, you know, brought me into the world of psychiatry and psychology, gave me the laws of men there, and it did nothing for my ugliness. Absolutely nothing. Then, you know, maybe sports and education. So, maybe I could, be this great athlete to kind of redeem myself. Sports did absolutely nothing for me. Maybe education. Maybe you can be smart enough and go to a university in D.C. More law, absolutely nothing. My mom sent me to correctional schools. The entire purpose of the school is to have a law system to correct you. You know what it did? Nothing. Other things, other laws that try to save me. You know, I got arrested, went to jail, got put on probation, got locked up. Maybe punishment. Maybe he has to learn the consequences. And when he learns the consequences, then maybe something can come out. Nothing. Nothing. You know what changed? Me? Going back to the story about Tamar and Judah and Ruth and Boaz, it's when this person came into my life. And he said, you know what, son? All of your lawlessness and sin and rebellion, I pay for it. I die for it. I satisfy it under my death. And then I bury it in a tomb, raised triumphant. And by the way, son, also, all my perfect standards that I did, even though you've never done anything right, even though you hate me and you despise me and you have everything in the world to just throw godlessness towards me, I give you my perfect record. And you know what? No matter what you do in the future, it will never change. Brothers and sisters, it was Christ being that to me, attaching himself to me, that changed everything. You want to know the power of law? Show you that it can do nothing for a sinner. But when Boaz comes into the picture and he loves sinners by grace, oh my goodness, it's over. It's over. So he brings horror out of horror. He makes beautiful things by gospel love, not law. This is why I have a problem, guys. You know, and I already told you I'm going to be long, so whatever. This is why I have a problem, guys, with the way we just reduce sin in the church. You know, we say like, hey, you know what? Maybe like you can kind of twist it and flip it and kind of make yourself feel a little bit better about your past. And maybe like as a Christian, you can kind of like reduce the standards of God and, you know, it's not perfection. You're not that bad. You're okay. And you know what that does? It strips us of this ability to see a God who takes horrendous, horrible rebels and says, I love you outside of anything. Take my righteousness. It robs us of this Boaz who says, no law. I am good for them. You know what? I'm going to love sinners that way. Reducing things, changing things. But there's one more thing I would say. Christ continues to make wonder from horror by love, not law. He continues to make wonder from horror by love, not law. Look, this is in verse 14, 15. Remember Naomi? What's Naomi? Naomi's like, it's not going too well in Israel. I think I'm just going to go sell out and like, you know, be in the prosperity gospel with the pagans and Moabs. You know, it's a little bit more comfortable over there. Husband dies. She's like, you know what? I'm still selling out. Two sons die. I'm still selling out. Eventually, she goes back. So this is Naomi. Naomi is the person who basically walks away from God, denies him, and basically says, you know what? I'm going to live with the pagans because you know what? They got more stuff. Right? That's very common today, right? So check this out. Look what happens in verse 14. Then the woman said to Naomi, praise the Lord who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. Listen to what is said to this pagan sellout Jew who left and went to Moab. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. I think there's an illustration that helps me like kind of present this. My son, he's someone who he likes to build things and he's a perfectionist. And anytime he builds something and it breaks, his world is over. Because for him, he has one chance to make something. And as soon as that chance is pulled away, it's over. And you know what? I think that's how we are as Christians. We're that way. We see Christ more like someone who gives us a second chance to do all of God's will and to succeed in every realm and to be an amazing, flawless parent and to be a Proverbs 30,000 wife. God, give me this one chance to build this perfect structure unto you. But they say to Naomi, you know what Christ is? Christ is someone who regularly takes your shattered, screwed up lives and the pieces and he builds them again over and over and over. He's not someone who gives you a chance to do something. He's someone who comes to the pieces, destruction in your relationships, your marriage, your parenting, your life, and he says, you know what? Boaz is a restorer of life. He's not someone who gives you a chance to then do something unbreakable, but he's someone who his gospel invincibility and power comes into all the wreckage and restores life. Guys, I know, we're a church, we're a small church, we all know our issues. And we think that. We think, man, God, I just missed out. You know, like, it's gone so far, it's gotten so bad, but Naomi comes to understand that Boaz restores life when there's death and destruction. He continues to make wonder from the ashes and ore of our lives by love, not law. So, it's really funny because after we get into this story about these women and whatnot, we get a genealogy. Look what it says in verse 17. The neighbor woman said, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This is the genealogy of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron, Hezron fathered Ram, father Adim. Like, what? Why you put a name list at the end of this wonderful story? You know, I know you people. You guys intentionally avoid the places in Scripture where the names are listed. You probably never read Numbers once in your life. the pastor says twice. What's that say for the rest of y'all? But check this out. This is a marvelous, sweeping conclusion about the elephant in the room, law. Now, I'll unpack that firstly by saying God's purpose for existence is a saving Christ, not a better you. Why do you say that? Well, we have a link of births in history that goes back to the time of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Father Abraham, yeah. And it entirely goes over the whole period of the law and goes into the people that go to David. Why on earth would we have a genealogy about births that goes from the pagan patriarchs, bypasses the entire era of the law, hundreds of years, and then goes to Boaz, and then goes to David, who then connects to the greater David Christ? Why? Simply said, because the purpose of existence is not you being better with Christ's help, but the purpose of existence, what creation has been waiting for, what birth has been producing, is a righteous Christ. The whole Bible, the whole universe is about a perfect and righteous Christ, not a better you. That's why this genealogy is there. You say, oh my gosh, how could you say that? I've been hearing the whole life that the whole purpose of Christianity is to be like Jesus and to be better and to, you know, what would Jesus do? There is a very significant place about that in the Christian life. But what this shows us is that's not the most significant thing. The most significant thing is the fact that there is a greater David, a greater Boaz who comes and is perfect in your place. That's the Bible. The Bible's not VeggieTales. A bunch of moralistic stories how to inspire you to be a lawkeeper. No, no, no. This entire book has been waiting for a righteous Boaz to obey where you could not obey and die in your law place. That's the Bible. That's why this is there. So, going to Father's Day, thoughts. Man, your job is not to be the best guy you can be and be a superhero, but your job is to do everything you can to imperfectly point people to the fact that the whole Bible, all existence, looks to a perfect, loving Christ for sinners. Your job is not to bark commands at your wife to make her more respectable and manageable to you. Your job is to do all that you can to draw her into the reality that there is a Christ in heaven who loves her outside of anything that she does and does not despise her in any of her sins. So that's one thing we see here about the sweeping conclusion about law. Another conclusion we see is that God is working out his grand purposes with regular people doing regular things. God is working out his purposes with regular people doing regular things. Yo, guys, who are these people? Who are these people? They're bosses and workers. They're rednecks, farmers. Moms, daughter-in-law, sister-in-law. You notice that? And what are they doing? Hey, you can eat my stuff. Hey, let me tell you some words of encouragement. Hey, let me find a place for you. They're just regular people doing regular things. And yet these regular people are doing regular things are this little story that's attached to the greatness of the gospel. Guys, the greatness of the gospel frees us to be regular people who do regular things that are eternally significant. You know, like we think as men that we're supposed to be superheroes who are like these superhuman guys and all these realms. And what this story shows us is the greatness of the gospel can enable you to just be a regular person doing regular things that are eternally significant. Like helping your wife out with the kids. Like giving her time to recuperate. Like playing with your kids. Talking to them. Like being helpful and thoughtful and conscientious about small mundane things in your everyday job. By just being intentional with a brother in the church in a small way. Guys, we are so obsessed with trying to define ourselves by what we do. And so we're so bored with little mundane things. But this story shows us that the most mundane people are a part of God's eternal purposes that are of most significance. Guys, that just changes everything about the way I view life when I see the greatness of the gospel and how it qualifies things. You know, I just remember, I'm going long, I'm going to keep going long, whatever. Man, I just remember, like, I was in seminary and you know, I was studying at the master's seminary, and I'm, you know, Hebrew and Greek, and I'm going to be a pastor, and I'm preaching. Bro, I could not even freaking sit down and, like, feed my kids and help them out with something really basic and sweep the floor. You know what that's about? Oh, you know what it's about? Because you're doing God's work. No, it's because I am not impressed with the glory of the gospel, and therefore I'm bored with mundane, everyday things. I want to be so great for God, I can't be a regular person doing regular things for my family. That's what that was about. But this story just totally shakes and rips that and changes it. I'll say a few more things. God is working out marvelous things and miserable things. The sweeping conclusion of this view of law, God is working marvelous things and miserable things. Look, what happened here is death, exile, homelessness, hunger, bankruptcy, and shame. But yet, at the end of all this is a connection and relation to Christ. So a lot of times, we think like this, man, there is just addiction, and there's shame, and there's pain, and there's relationships broken, and there's abandonment, and there's divorce, and there's step-parents, and there's abuse, and there's all these things, and yet this story says that, no, that's not the end. That's not the most definitive thing, because at the end of all that is a David and a greater David. Wow. This is amazing that death and abandonment and exile and homelessness could somehow be connected and related to the beauty of Christ. There is no insignificance in the miserable things that just suck, because there's a connection to Jesus at the end of all those things. I'll say two more things. Yes, I went to an hour. I finally did it. I did it. I'm always trying to like avoid going an hour. I made it, whatever. God is doing the most significant things behind the scenes. Listen to me, church. God is doing the most significant things behind the scenes. The book of Judges, have you guys read the book? Have you at least read the book of Judges? All right. Judges is not Numbers, so I think somebody got that. Judges, you notice that Ruth and Boaz are not in Judges? Who's in Judges? You know, dude with a sword, Samson knocking down, ripping down gates. There's no Ruth. There's no Boaz. There's none of this. But what's the most significant story in the book of Judges? Talk to me. This story, right? It's not even in the book of Judges. It's in the book of Ruth, but it's not in the book of Judges. Guys, the greatness of the gospel means that the most insignificant things are oftentimes the most significant things in God's purposes. That means that the things that no one knows about are the things that are glorious and wonderful. That means you, mom, at home, with stinking, whining, I know people that are oh, how could you say that? Come on. Some of y'all ladies relate with me. Stinking, whining, complaining, sick kids. There is nothing insignificant about that behind-the-scenes stuff. Absolutely not. Redneck Boaz in the fields is the greatest story in the whole book of Judges, and it's not even in it. We're a skeleton crew here. You're volunteering in places that just are not very pleasant, and you're doing things that people don't want to do. There's nothing insignificant about that. There's nothing insignificant about Absolutely not. You're doing things that no one cares about, no one's seeing. Man, you're in the home, and you a lot of what you do in the home, no one sees. But guys, there is nothing. It is eternally and awesome in the economy of gospel to be doing things that nobody knows about, according to Ruth. Guys, we are so much want to be visibly awesome, and I want to startle. Look, there's nothing wrong with this stuff. Nothing wrong with this stuff. I want to start a club. I want to get a master's degree. I want to do this great thing. How about this? How about just be faithful in the obscure? Nothing wrong with those things. This book just changes everything. And I'll say one more thing. Nothing wrong with those things. But what I'm saying is that this thing shows us that the most significant things are in the behind the scenes. That no one sees, no one knows about. The last point I would say, hour and 4 minutes. Yes, I'm going further. God is doing the most powerful things slowly and subtly. God is doing the most powerful things slowly and subtly. Listen to this. So this is attached to, this story has a significance in David, right? How far is David from this story? 200-400 years. So these people didn't see nothing about what was significant about what was going on until 300-400 years. And going even further than that, David's not significant apart from the greater David, right? So this event is connected to something that happened 300-400 years later, and that to another 1,000 years later. So really, this event is attached to something that took 1,400 years to really see itself. Y'all tracking with me? We think, because we're so obsessed with ourselves, that fast and quick and explosive is the work of God. 1,400 years. 1,400 years. Guys, some of you have been laboring in your homes, trying to bring the gospel in areas of your life, and you don't see nothing. But guess what? The most significant things that are going on are slow, and they're no less significant because they're slower. Some of you are trying to, disciple someone, and you're like, man, it's like I don't see much going on. Well, 1,400 years. Or you're in ministries in the church, and you're trying to get things going, and you just have like one person or two people that's really you're clicking with. So what? There's nothing insignificant about it. 1400 years, the greatest reality attached to this story. God is doing very glorious things, very significant things, very slowly, oftentimes. And to make it more practical, you know, reconcile church. Slow beginnings, slow movings. What does that mean for us? Oh, well, it's not big, it's not explosive, it's not fast. I don't know. No. 1400 years, Christ. So guys, I encourage you, man, because of the greatness of the gospel, everything you're doing in your life, no matter if it's slow and subtle and you don't see anything, God is indeed in it. So, hour and 6 minutes. Conclusion, finally. Guys, what does Ruth tell us is God's answer to our law issue? Christ and Him crucified. What is the book of Ruth's answer to the fact that we just do what we feel like, no matter how much we think we're supposed to do this? Christ and Him crucified. I'm going to have crowd participation. What is our answer in a world that's lawless in light of the fact that we could never do anything to be right? What's the answer? What's the answer? Y'all, that's the answer. This love story gives us our once and for all final answer as to what is the answer to that question. Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Amen? All right, Father, thank you so much just for giving us just a real perspective of how the law that we are obsessed with making our husband could never do that. So that we could see the law of God as this wonderful signpost to our loving death, resurrected Christ. In Jesus' name, amen.
That concludes our message, and we hope that you were inspired by it. If you'd like to hear more about the gospel or find out more about Reconciled Church Miami, please connect with us using one of the ways listed on our website, reconciledchurchmiami.org.